Continue plunging into our next major novel here. And let me say to the graduate students here today, I wonder if I could huddle with you all after class, and we're going to have a slight shift of game plan, but it's going to be very similar for you. So if we could all meet together after class, if that's not unreasonable. We could give some assignments and then set your minds at ease about what these things will be. Okay? So, so do come up afterwards. I may have forgotten completely that I said this by that time, but I'll know what to do. You just come. Speaking of the idiot. With our brief introduction to Dostoevsky, we emphasized Notes from Underground and Crime and Punishment, stressing in part Dostoevsky's deformation of the real, what he calls is fantastic realism, and stressing it as his vision of how to depict the full spiritual dimension of the human in an age that has already begun to be dominated by fact, and that is continues to be our age. And such an age leaves no room for depiction of the spiritual. So, in a flawless logic, in thinking about this problem, a depiction of the spiritual is required then to be grotesque. Actually, when we think about it, it seems not such a far stretch. As medieval theology might say, I don't know whether it does say or not, when grace enters the world, right, it changes the natural world. It tends to deform nature. This is not too far from that famous statement of Flannery O'Connor about the grotesque. Miss O'Connor said, we all know that evil is grotesque, but what too few of us recognize is that the good is grotesque. As she said, because it's under construction. It's a wonderful insight. The good in us, in our world, is not finished. It's a form, but it's not finished. So the presentation of it in a work of art is likely, if it has any insight, to involve the grotesque. So the grotesque is part of Dostoevsky's art, to be sure. So I'd expect you to keep these works in mind, the Notes from Underground, Crime and Punishment, whether you've read them or not. We rehearsed the story of them a bit last time. Make yourself familiar with the ideas expressed in them. Know something of their themes, because they mark the beginning of Dostoevsky's mature work. And that his work assumes, I repeat, ever greater importance in a world in which we find ourselves further and further into an age of materialism that seems all enveloping. We spoke of the literalism that has marked the development of the novel last time as well. So that the novel occupies a curious place in the development of modernity. On the one hand, it has adopted modernity with open arms. In the world of prose, in the boulevard realism that it depicts, and in its embrace of secularism, of the rule of no supernatural explanations, and so forth. On the other hand, it rather brilliant literary critic refers this to the Spanish American novel. It's Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria says that the novel always has a tension with the ruling discourse of the age. I'm not sure if he sees that with enough depth, but it's quite a brilliant perception. So that it has to adopt it and to try, in a sense, to co-opt the prestige of the ruling discourse of the age. And yet at the same time, it wants to undermine it and to present a reality that is far greater, far deeper than the reality with which we are familiar in our everyday shallower perspective. So we try to satisfy our desire for the spiritual or the transcendent in an empirical age, in an empirical world, with conventions with which we're comfortable. That is to say, science fiction, fantasy, horror, even. Right? Transferring our longing to a starship, or to Middle Earth, or to Narnia, even. But always, it's literal. Always, it is in another world that doesn't disturb ours. We keep the empiricism intact. The whole human register is never given to us in these works of fantasy. They're never made to collide with our world. And we simply transfer an empiricism into a strange world. But we don't attempt to depict the odd shapes and forms and movements of the spirit that actually do occur. That, however, is what Gogol was doing, showing Russia as it really was, with that accent on the strange, the bizarre, the grotesque, and never forgetting the fact, the issue, that it all has to do for him with what the potential for the spirit is. What is the movement of the spirit in his age? What is the soul of Russia? Dostoevsky, of course, learned from Gogol. This is what Dostoevsky is doing, but he's doing it in his own way. Think, if you will, of Midsummer Night's Dream. This is not entirely unapropos. The story of Bottom, right? Bottom's dream. Bottom, who wore an ass's head, right? But who was lifted up into the arms of the fairy queen. And when he returns from his dream, he says, "Eye hath not heard, and ear hath not seen," and so forth. We get a comic and grotesque performance from him. But it's not hard to see, with one eye squinted, that he is depicting the action of grace, that Shakespeare is depicting the action of grace in the character of Bottom. He has gone beyond the natural, gone beyond himself, been wrapped into the third heaven, the language of St. Paul that he mangles. The very bottom has to be lifted up for grace. Grace does not simply work on the noble and the elegant, the Platonic side of us, but has to cover all of it. And therefore, the grotesque and the comic are at work. And for Dostoevsky, think of this. You've heard the story of his life now. You've seen you can sense the extremes of life that he was exposed to in the prison camp, right? In his struggles in Petersburg, his poverty, his epilepsy, the death of his, at the same time, in very quick succession, his first wife, his son, young son, both died. And so he was truly plunged into the extremes of life's experience. There had to be a way to convey the heights and depths of what he knew of life, and to depict, as Gogol wanted, holy Russia running through all of this chaos, and all this complexity. So he called his style fantastic realism, and entered into what some critics have called his cruel talent. Right? A cruel talent, because he gives us such violent things that happen, so that even holiness has to be presented to us in the form of a prostitute. Pitiable and poor. Sophia, the soul of the world, who has been dragged into the dirt, but is nonetheless still a saving power in Christ. crime and punishment. The poet Yeats wrote a well-known line that says, "I must lie down where all ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart." And here saying that, well, this is what the poet must do, that he has to be there among the dirt and the foul side that constitutes where our heart lives. The ladders are those ladders of spirituality, the ladders of transcendence, the ladders of meaning that Dante talks about when he talks about the polysemous nature of scripture and of his poem, right? The many meanings that it has. All those meanings, wonderful, moral, allegorical, anagogical, whatever that means, all right, have no substance without being rooted in what Yeats called the foul and rag and bone shop of the heart. And an artist who, an author who wants to leave that out, I'm giving you a prettified picture of what constitutes grace or the good or our reality or what is moral. It's giving us an unreal picture and an art that is not really efficacious. So Dostoevsky's wager is a large one. It's a dangerous one. And we read him because I think, to a great degree, more so than less, he succeeded. And we read him to learn then how to read ourselves. Now in The Idiot, it's especially true. And what impresses me on going and rereading The Idiot is how different it is from Crime and Punishment. Dostoevsky did not find a recipe for writing a novel and do different versions of it as he went along. More so, it seems to me, even than Faulkner, who is very varied in his career, Dostoevsky changes in significant ways and moves steadily toward the unknown. And it seems that he writes The Idiot in a sense because he is trying to find out, you know, the answer, or find out a way to formulate the things that he has found so mysterious, so enigmatic in life. So that open religiousness, that open confrontation of religion and crime, religion and atheism that we found in Crime and Punishment, it's all gone. Right? It's not there anymore. Different concerns come in. Many of them seem to be borrowed from German Romanticism, the sublime, the grotesque, body and soul. We're here in the heart of the intellectual problematic of modern Europe, France, and Germany. Body severed from soul, mind in res extensa, as Descartes called matter, extended, how do you translate that? Extended thing.
Yeah.
So we're in a different world, and one that is in a significant degree more enigmatic than the world of Crime and Punishment. Crime and Punishment shocks us with its bold and daring collision and equation of opposites in our lives, right? The sacred prostitute. But The Idiot also takes opposites, but doesn't seem to give us answers. It gives us a very perplexing problem, that presentation. Embodied in our character, The Idiot, Prince Myshkin himself. So we could say that four means that Dostoevsky has for bringing out this extra dimension in the human that has been suppressed in modernity would include grotesque. And we just talked about that briefly. The polyphonic, and about this term, of course, you need to consult Mikhail Bakhtin, or M.M. Bakhtin, as he's sometimes the author's name is given, Problems of Dostoevsky's Poetics. Can you even read this in back? This is, we're about to give out here. In which he talks about the polyphonic as a new technique, that many voices are heard, that more serene presentation of a simple dialogue is gotten away from. Dostoevsky does not, more often, does not give us a novelized drama in which you have characters talking fairly, observing good rules of not interrupting each other and carrying on in a sensible and clear way. There's a pell-mell nature of language in Dostoevsky. People are interrupting, catcalls occur, violent objections, and so forth. There's a great range, and a great range of styles all at once. This is part of the polyphony, is different styles of language colliding together, all part of what happens when you have a novel of the city, which people come from all over, different parts of the world colliding together, not used to each other, and so in a more unexpected way, forming a sound collage. So this is part of Dostoevsky's art, again, to raise things above the level of what we consider the standard, real. We have mentioned also the oniric. And there are some fine works of critical discussion on Dostoevsky's symbolisms used in his dream presentations. In Crime and Punishment, there are three, I believe, major dreams, each one of them of a different kind entirely, but they are structural kingpins of the novel. They're very important. It's very important to read them very carefully. Oniric is important because of its presentation of a different state of consciousness, so that there's a naturalistic witness that we do live on different levels at the same time. So different aspects of reality can be stressed. Different ways of expressing them can be explored. And that's been a very important aspect of his art. And also one thing that's been commented on, the iconic. And here, you have to study the Russian tradition more than we have been able to do in our hurried presentation on the run, as we've gone through the first couple of weeks. But the icon, of course, was a terribly important part of Orthodox Christianity, and especially of Russian Orthodox Christianity. And study of the icons will reveal the importance of the way that they are structured, the way that the scene is set in a way. Famously, of course, they ignore standard perspective. It's claimed that icons have inverse perspective. I'm still have a hard time visualizing that. There is one picture that I want to show you sometime that I think I can understand how that works. And, you know, if I can do it, I know you can, because I just have a hard time with that kind of, you know, topology or whatever it is. Anyway, Dostoevsky's iconic sense is not a theatrical sense in which we end with a particular blocking of characters as if we'd drawn out a place for them to stand on the stage. It's not like Sophocles, but is rather as though an icon were being designed. The famous one in Crime and Punishment is the moment of Raskolnikov's confession to Sonya, because there they are in a somewhat darkened room, sitting at a table, the candle in the middle, candle is guttering out. This is the last moment of this chapter. And Dostoevsky writes, and I wish I had the text here, whether he writes about the table, the candle guttering out, and he said, and at the table sat a murderer and a prostitute, and between them the sacred book. You know, who would have thought? He says it better than that. But you know, it's that union of opposites, and much, much more, the way that he can present a certain scene. I think this happens at the end of Crime and Punishment as well, but I think it happens in The Idiot as well, which, as I said, stresses religion a great deal less, but nonetheless, the power of those moments of in which there's been so much violent action and coming together, and then all of a sudden a stillness. You know, look for that iconic imagination to emerge at this time and to lift the meaning of these scenes a great deal. Okay, so in addition to all of these, and I hope all these are somewhat clear in my brief explanation of them all. We can come back to them later, but we'll need to. In addition to all these, there is also, in this novel, I think more so than in Crime and Punishment, a tendency toward allegory. And we'll have to start thinking about allegory. And sometimes I get started thinking about allegory and I can't stop. Allegory is if you only understand it, say, from Samuel Taylor Coleridge's point of view, that it's a bad thing, don't. If you only understand it from, you know, Edmund Spencer's point of view, that it's a wonderful thing, that's not quite right either. We have to think about allegory. What can allegory mean in a modern world that has renounced, you know, a religious cosmos, a religious discourse, in which the world is supposed to be, in a sense, leveled out, and there are not supposed to be other meanings. They're just supposed to be us.
Mm-hmm. Did you just say Samuel Coleridge did not like allegory? Because I thought his A Rime of the Ancient Mariner sounded an awful lot like allegory to me.
Well, you got me, or I should say you got him. But yeah, he's on record in his criticism.
Okay.
As saying there's a great deal of difference between a symbol and an allegory.
Okay. Right. I didn't know if he was trying to make it literal when I was reading it as an allegory. Or...
No. You're quite right.
Okay.
And like I say, I'm stepping out of the way. It's not me.
Sorry.
It's him. You know, it was Coleridge who famously said that there's a great deal of difference between a symbol and an allegory. Actually, I think Goethe said this before him, but I mean, Coleridge says it very memorably, and not just for English speakers. That a symbol develops its meaning from within. Right? There's an organicness, in other words, about it, whereas an allegory brings it in from outside and seems to be arbitrary, that an author can say anything, you know, and so forth. And so there's something kind of a scandal for the person who, for that aesthetic that wants to develop the work of art in an organic way, which is, after all, an admirable thing. So a defense of allegory has got to be mounted. It's one that Coleridge is not capable of. It is something that I think emerges after 1848. You know, I don't know if I've stressed that date obsessively enough, but 1848 was a very important year, the year of the Second Revolution in Europe. 1789 was called the Bourgeois Revolution by the left, and 1848 was going to be the great year in which the proletariat came to the fore and, you know, created the People's Republic of Everything, right, PRE. It failed, of course, but it was a turning point for much of thought, society, and culture. And it was after 1848 that art and literature began to take up its stance that we consider now customary, that the artist, that the writer is is writing in criticism of, in opposition to, the society, the rulers of society, the powers that be, the authorities in society, rather than along with that society. Before that, even the Romantics, as bold as they were with their new ideas, were not openly writing in a counter way toward the way life is lived, the way the society is distributed, and so forth. After 1848, it became a customary thing. So, in such a world, allegory became an impossible thing. And so that's really the root of its power, that if it appears, oh my God, it's an impossible thing, you see. So this happens especially in Baudelaire. Who was born very close to the time of Dostoevsky, the same generation. So Baudelaire, Dostoevsky, same generation. And we're looking now in the modern world at allegory as having an additional dimension. It has an experiential dimension. Here's what I mean. Something allegorical happens. It has to happen. It cannot just be designated by the author, but it has to be experienced by a character as, wow, what the, what just happened? It seemed to me like it was some allegory. No. This is the idea. And that is the hallmark of modern allegory. It adds a dimension, of course, of irony, too, right? Because it can't happen, and yet it does. I'm giving you, in brief, a theory of allegory that Walter Benjamin gives at length in his book about German Trauerspiel. And he also then expands on it when he does a study of Charles Baudelaire. It's a brilliant piece of work. I think it's as applicable to this novel, The Idiot, as it is to Baudelaire or to the German Trauerspiel, which, for very good reasons, is not very well known to us. I've read a few, and they're pretty bizarre. So allegory, look for it. And I think it happens frequently. Often it can happen as literary allusion. Right, as when Prince Myshkin says that he lived in a fog in Switzerland until in one town his head was cleared by the bray of an ass. And, you know, not as if not to, you know, as if to say, didn't you get it? Aglaya, I believe, or one of the sisters, says, well, that's happened in mythology, you know. One could even fall in love with an ass, you know. And so, you know, it's all put out in the open as though the author is nudging you, right, you know, with his elbow. So nothing, it merely develops in a slow, organic, and symbolic way. Partly because of those three brilliant sisters, Aglaya, Alexandra, and Adelaida, because they're literary, because they're so sharp, because much of the activity of the novel is their salon or related places, we have a very high literary consciousness and allusion. And so when something is brought up, when an idea is brought up, well, it gets tossed around. And that turns the whole scene into something of an allegory. When Prince Myshkin, well, maybe I shouldn't give this one away, but I will. When Prince Myshkin sends a letter to Aglaya, she keeps it in her copy of Don Quixote. And then, of course, she doesn't realize until someone points that out how ironic that is. You know, this is just Dostoevsky messing with us, as we would say nowadays, but doesn't do it for trivial reasons. He doesn't do it for trivial reasons. He's really putting our relation of the mind to reality in question. Yes, uh-huh.
Distinction between something that's allegorical and an allegory, or have they kind of merged? Like, I know that's a really difficult question.
I didn't catch it. Can you rephrase that?
Like, a work can be allegorical without being a strict allegory, you know?
Okay, that's the part I don't understand. Okay, no, okay.
You're
so you're talking
like
about the difference between, now see if this is right, the difference between the allegory of poets and the allegory of theologians, as Dante calls it. In the allegory of poets, the poet intends to write an allegory.
Mm-hmm.
In the allegory of theologians, you can take any text, as long as it's, you know, got some substance to it, and
mm-hmm.
and read allegorical meanings in it. Is that what you're talking about? Like, in other words, there could be an unintentional allegory. Is that what you said?
No.
Nope, okay.
I was thinking more of, you know, like Shakespeare, like the sort of thing that you see in Shakespeare where occasionally his figures do seem to, you know, be an example of allegory, but later on in the play they don't fit that category.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of change from time to time. And like in the Roman de la Rose, you see Guillaume de Lorris's Roman is an allegory, and
mm-hmm.
then you get into Jean de Mun, and it's more allegorical and less strictly allegory because he just, you know, packs it with so much.
Scott, I want to defer you on that.
Well, there is. Let's talk about overt allegory, on the one hand, in which the thing. What Coleridge called allegory in the simple sense, what he was saying was an inferior form of art, he said, is just a picture language with counters. This is that. This is that. This is that. And what he speaks of as symbol, his famous definition of symbol, that it renders... it partakes of the reality that it renders intelligible. This is a famous statement in Coleridge's definition of symbol. So there, the allegorical meaning, if we want to call it that, rises from within the thing itself. So in an allegory like Spencer's, for example, or Let's choose something even more obvious. Take a TV commercial. Years ago, there used to be a product that was supposed to fix your car engine. And there were various allegorical cartoon characters. Sticky Rings, Dirty Grime, Blackie Carbon. Blackie Carbon has a cigar, and he looks like a kind of tough fellow, and he blows smoke into your engine. So, this is the kind of allegory that Coleridge is talking about. Now here it's humorous, to be sure. So what you're talking about is something different. You're talking about what Coleridge actually means by symbol. You see, where it's not so deliberate and overt, where
and
we have to descend into the thing itself, and out of that comes the meaning.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a huge topic and can go into many authors as well, you know. So, but be on the lookout for those moments in which, you know, all of a sudden, the characters themselves seem aware that hey, this is excessively structured, you know, and it's not cheap. It's not like are we in some kind of fiction here? But it's rather what really is the meaning of what we're involved in, you know. So. And to figure it out with literary allusion, with ideas, is part of this project, The Idiot. There's also the polarization that goes on so much in Prince Mishkin. Well, in the opening scene, we have this train, you know, barreling along, this great modern beginning. This should make a great film. They've tried, of Prince Mishkin sitting opposite Rogozhin. Right? The Rogozhin is dark and squat and what's the expression on his face? It's
insolent.
Insolent, good. Yeah, that was a good mimicking of it, yes. across from Prince Mishkin blonde-haired, ectomorphic, right, thin, tall and thin, and with a gentle and innocent expression, is not just opposites, but seeming to be an allegory of spirit and body, soul and body. And what are the things that prepossess Mishkin? What are the things that he thinks about all the time? Well, he thinks about death by guillotine, when the head is separated from the body. He thinks about what must consciousness be like in those moments before one meets one's death by execution. Now we can say, okay, a lot of this is based on some of Dostoevsky's own experience, but it's not merely a self-centered exploration of it. He's not doing it to biographize. He has, as we say in the literary world, he has motivated his material, by which we mean something slightly different from motivated, as in what's your motive, what's my motive for the crime, and so forth. It means motivated, it means you've made it into a motif. It's something that interacts fully in the universe of meaning, in the web or cloud of meaning that's in this novel. It's part of the motifs. So the experience of epilepsy, also a severance of soul from body in some way. Right? All of these are extreme limit cases, all of them relating to Mishkin in some way. So we see all these schematizations of separation of soul and body. And it is, of course, not by chance, but it is to anatomize our modern condition. Yes,
So, just backtracking a little bit, this second level of allegory where the characters in the novel are recognizing the allegories, mm-hmm. are you saying that came about around 1848? Is that when that began to arise?
Well, I may be being over-schematic myself, but I think there's a relation there. In other words, okay. it's what happens in a modern world, right, in which, it's preparation has been going on for a long time, because for a couple of centuries before Dostoevsky, poetic allegory had come to seem staler and staler, more and more contrived and conventional, robbed of life. So how does one return it to life?
Okay. Well, it seems like, I don't know, this might be part of the industrializing tendencies of the era, but it seems like people might be more comfortable letting the author do the allegorizing for them, you know, because it makes it easier to consume.
More standard novel in which stuff happens and then the author comes in and says, ah, who could imagine that, blah, 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 blah. No, I mean, that happens a lot, and that's what Dostoevsky sought to transcend. Good point. Okay, so where are we going with this allegory? Looking at, the different aspects of Dostoevsky's art. Now, The Idiot is really the next step after Dostoevsky's extensive study of the Raskolnik, right? The rebel, the schismatic, that began with Notes from Underground and continued through Raskolnikov himself. The Idiot takes a step into the enigmatic. And I have to say that if there's any major work that is still up for grabs in the canon of great literature, it's probably The Idiot. That is to say, its interpretation has not been generally agreed on. So it's an exciting field. But the conviction is still quite often voiced that Dostoevsky intended in this novel a Christ figure, although he never said such a thing. So whatever he is, Dostoevsky's Idiot is not a mere case history of a strange and uniquely maladjusted being. Nor, it seems to me, is it, and I can give you plenty of examples why, is it a history of a holy being. Nor is it a portrayal of an epileptic for the sake of getting that down, into fiction. Again, I think it's a fairly motivated presentation of epilepsy. It's not done for its own sake. And I think that it's not at the same time what Dostoevsky said he wanted to write. And this was to write the story of a perfectly beautiful man. You have a letter to his niece that he wrote and a letter to a friend in which he uses that phrase, a beautiful man. In Russian,
прекрасный,
прекрасный. Is an intensifier. Krasny means beautiful. It all, strange word, also means red, doesn't it?
Yes.
A perfectly beautiful man. This was his fascination that motivated him in the ordinary way to get up and try this, you know, work on this novel. And he wrote this intention early on before he had written the novel. So we can, in fact, justifiably say, with that intention beginning him, how did it turn out? You see, I don't think we should commit the intentional fallacy, as Wimsatt and Beardsley talked about the intentional fallacy, and assume that when an author wrote outside of the work that he wanted to do X, Y, or Z, or he intended to do that, that he did it. It can help us compare a supposed intention with a reality. It's just as with us, right? As in all our lives, we constantly say, I'm intending to do X, Y, or Z, but the record shows something a little bit different, you know. So. Mm-hmm.
Yes, just when you said a Christ figure, I was wondering, do you mean specifically in the sense of resembling Jesus of Nazareth, or just in the sense of being an anointed one, a Messiah figure? Like, do you mean like in the sense of a Christian Christ figure, or just in like the sense of the?
I mean, I'm not making those fine distinctions really yet. In any way.
No.
Let's hang on.
Sorry,
and see. Let's hang on and see. I'm not sure entirely what we're going to decide. In a sense, I feel like we're going to have to decide. How to interpret this novel, but probably more likely we'll have to have a tussle about it. I think so. That will be fine. Dostoevsky started work on this novel so many times. He rejected whole plots that he came up with. He rejected characters that he came up with. He'd go down the line and try it out, and then he'd throw it away. And we also know that he started work on two other novels at other times in his life and threw them away entirely. He said they weren't going to work out well, so he threw them away. So we know he's enough of an artist that this novel, The Idiot, is not a botched job. It's not something that he got off with a great idea and then found that it presented a lot of problems and decided, oh well, to go with it anyway. No. Dostoevsky, the perfectionist, threw out whole novels, basically, in order to write this, as it were, novels in nuce, novels in a nutshell, in order to come up with this. And at the end, he is on record as having said that he is pleased with the idea. He felt that he should have had more time to execute it better. So we do have that as well. I don't doubt the idea, he said. And all this brings out that for Dostoevsky, there are two sides to the novelist's act, that the poet has the insight that forms the kernel of a genuine artistic work. But it is the artist who must carry that out and execute it in a work of art. You see, the two are entirely different. They collaborate in making a work of art. This is a distinction that seems to me thoroughly sensible and one that we all ought to adopt, although nomenclature is really slippery and will continue to slip and slide anytime we see it. Creative process has different stages, and it can, of course, can fail at any stage, but that original insight, this whole story of the composition of the idiot seems testimony to the idea that a true poet has an original insight that he can't be shaken from. And as we see him try different structures, different plots, different characters, that's a whole later stage of the process. If he throws them away, he doesn't go back absolutely to zero. He goes back to the original idea, which in the nature of the original idea, by its very nature, is not yet stated. It's intuited. It's discerned as an insight. So how to express that is the riddle of the creative process. All right.
Mm-hmm. This is just kind of a random question, but I was just wondering if he was on record for saying anywhere what maybe his, like, what work he wrote that he found the most pleasure in or took the most pride in or was kind of like his own favorite or baby, if you will.
Dusty Riskin?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, he ended up usually writing for the same reason that most writers write. We mentioned Caroline Gordon, who hated to write, and people said, well, why do you do it? She said, because I must. In Dostoevsky's case, sometimes he had to just to keep body and soul together, as a matter of fact. But he was never satisfied with anything he wrote. He always felt that it wasn't quite what he wanted to. I understand that myself very well. I feel that about everything I do. So.
And wait till we get to the Brothers Karamazov. We'll talk about
the
formation of that conception as well, which was in fact longer and grander than he was able to execute. So that's all, I think, going to be very interesting. His notebooks have been published. I mean, this is cool. It happened some time ago. The University of Chicago Press has them in paperback. The Notebooks to the Idiot and the Notebooks to a number of his other works have been published, so we can actually study that creative process out front. If you really get into Dostoevsky, you should do this. So,
in translation,
though? Oh, for sure. I should have mentioned that. Mishkin is viewed so often as some form of Christ figure who brings compassion and an innocent-heartedness to people, a standard which they really is beyond them, they can't practice, but at the same time that he shocks and amuses people, he also endears himself to many. He has a charm, a winningness, and an impressiveness that belies his naivete that sets him off in an awkward way. But, you know, we need to look at his character and look at a few scenes to begin with this complex figure. We might want to look at the scene. You remember that he comes to the Yepanchins. Yeah, incidentally, let's write down some Russian names. It might be help to you. I don't know if you want to take the trouble. In general, my advice is keep reading, don't make notes, make lines, you know, and just keep going. But sometimes it becomes necessary to write down somebody's full name just so that you can keep track of who they are. Who is this Yevgeny Pavlovich? And so forth. That, they keep talking about, oh, that guy. So we have, of course, Lev Nikolaevich Mishkin, whose last name, incidentally, means little mouse. That little mouse. okay, we have Parfion, strange first name, Rogozhin, both in their 20s. We have Nastasya Filipovna. Barashkova?
Is that Barashkova?
Yeah. I guess so. Isn't it? Or NFB, as she's noted as at one point in the novel, the point I found confusing until I went back and found her last name. We have Afanasy Ivanovich Totsky, who was her whatever captor or patron and lover. We have Ivan Fyodorovich Yepanchin. Big novel with a lot of characters. His wife, Lizaveta Prokofievna. And, okay, generally the women take on a last name and add an A to it, so. But you never see that, actually, I don't think, in this novel. We have the daughters, Alexandra, Adelaida, Aglaya, the triple A, also a little bit of a schematic, if not allegorical, then schematic. There's a great deal of schematicness in this novel that seems to make it less realistic and more contrived, right? More authorial, less natural, more artificial. Think of those polarities as well, and try, if you can, to strip our tendency, to keep away from that tendency to say natural means good, artificial means bad. A work of art is an artifice, right? Otherwise, we're out of business here. So keep that in mind. These are all Ivanovnas, because they're all daughters of Ivan. Who else do we have? Oh, we've got the Ivolgin family. Mm. All right. Now what's his name? Ardalion. Lord, what a strange name. Ardalion. Last name? It's a strange patronymic as well. Ivolgin. And then Gavril. That's a V. Ardalionovich Ivol Ganya. So you gotta keep all these in, all these straight, the nicknames as well as the family name, the patronymic, and so forth. there's more, but I think those, if you got that, then you've pretty much got a thumbnail guide. All right. So where was I? Okay, in this scene with the Yepanchins, right? This is the scene in which he's come and just presented himself as a distant, far distant relative. Excuse me. and you know, hopes to get involved with them in their lives. You know, presents themselves to them, and so they're astounded. He's already amazed the servant, who was kind of scandalized that he didn't have the right kind of ceremony, and so forth. He doesn't go by social order at all, yet he's charming, fresh, and delightful. And though they're shocked by him, they're also quite taken with him. And Adelaida says, now tell us how you were in love. So we want to look, if you've got this edition, look on page 71. Actually, she says this at the bottom of page 70. And at the top of 71, this is at the very end, if you have a different edition, of part 1, chapter 5, and then going on into chapter 6. "I haven't been in love," answered the prince, just as quietly and earnestly. "I was happy in a different way." "How then? In what?" "Very well, I'll tell you," uttered the prince, as though deep in thought. So he then tells about back when he was in Switzerland, going into a live in a Swiss village, and there finding some very interesting people, and finding the gang of children that he began to get to know. And we read from this, and I go about 10 lines down. I'm going to read extensively through the next few pages, skipping around a little bit. So bear with me, this will take a few minutes, but I want us to plunge back into this one scene. He says, "I used to tell them everything. I concealed nothing from them. Their fathers and relations were all cross with me, for the children couldn't get on without me, finally, and were always flocking around me. And the schoolmaster, finally, even became my chief enemy. I made many enemies there, and all on account of the children. Even Schneider reproved me. And what were they so afraid of? Children can be told everything, everything. I've always been astonished by the thought of how little grown-ups, by the thought of how little grown-ups understand children, even fathers and mothers, their own children. Nothing should be concealed from children on the pretext that they are little and that it is too early for them to understand." And it goes on in that way. Move on to the next page, in 72, and at about a dozen lines down, he says, "The children used to laugh at me at first, and they even began throwing stones at me after they saw me kiss Marie. And I only kissed her once. No, don't laugh." The prince made haste to check the smile on the faces of his listeners. There was no love at all involved. "If only you knew what a miserable creature this was, you would be very sorry for her yourselves, as I was." And he goes on to explain, down about 8 lines. "Marie was the daughter of this very old woman, some 20 years old, weak and skinny. She had been consumptive for a long time, but she kept on going from house to house, hiring herself out to do hard work by the day, scrubbing floors, washing linens, sweeping out yards, and minding cattle. A French commercial traveler seduced her and took her away, and a week later left her alone on the road and went off on the sly. She came home begging, all filthy, in rags, with her boots in pieces. She had gone on foot the whole week, slept in the fields, and caught a dreadful cold. Her feet were covered in wounds. Her hands were swollen and chapped. Well, actually, she wasn't comely before that either. Only her eyes were gentle, kind, innocent. She was terribly silent." Let me go on, get more details of this scene, and more kind of the persecution. We look in the next page, just down at the bottom of the next page, last 7 lines. "Sometimes, very rarely, when the drunkards got drunk on Sunday, they would throw pennies to her for laughs, just like that, on the ground. Marie would pick them up without a word. She had begun to cough up blood by that time. At last, her rags were torn to absolute tatters, so that she was ashamed to show herself in the village, and she had gone barefoot since she came back. And it was then particularly that the children, the whole gang of them, there were a little over 40 school children, began jeering and even throwing dirt at her. She asked the cowherd to let her look after the cows, but he drove her away. Then she began going off for the whole day with the flock, of her own accord, without permission. But she was of great use to the cowherd, and he noticed it. He no longer drove her away, and sometimes even gave her the leftovers from his dinner, cheese and bread. He considered this as a great kindness on his part. And when her mother died, the pastor did not scruple to heap shame on Marie in church before all the people. Marie stood behind the coffin, as she was, in her rags, and cried. A crowd of people had collected to see how she would cry and walk behind the coffin. Then the pastor, he was still a young man, and his whole ambition was to become a great preacher, turned to them all and pointed to Marie, "Here you see the cause of this worthy woman's death." And it was not true, for the woman had been ill for 2 years. "Here she stands before you and dares not look at you, for she has been marked out by the finger of God. Here she is, barefoot and in rags, a warning to all who lose their virtue. Who is she? Her daughter." And so on in that vein. And imagine this infamy pleased almost everyone. But here the story took a certain turn. The children interfered, for by then the children were all on my side and had begun to love Marie. This was how it happened. I wanted to do something for Marie. She was badly in need of money, but I never had a farthing at that time. I had a little diamond pin, and I sold it to a peddler. He went from village to village buying and selling old clothes. He gave me 8 francs, and it was certainly worth 40. Excuse me. I was a long time trying to meet Marie alone. At last we met by a hedge outside the village on a bypath to the mountain behind a tree. Then I gave her the 8 francs and told her to take care of it because I should have no more. And then I kissed her and said that she mustn't think that I had any evil intent, and that I kissed her not because I was in love with her, but because I was very sorry for her, and that I had never from the very beginning thought of her as guilty, but only as unhappy. I wanted very much to comfort her at once and to persuade her that she shouldn't consider herself below everyone. But I think she didn't understand. I saw that at once, though she scarcely spoke all the time and stood before me with downcast eyes and horribly abashed. When I had finished, she kissed my hand, and I at once took her hand and would have kissed it, but she hastily pulled it away. Now skip the next 4 or 5 lines. The same day, everyone knew of it. The whole village, the whole brunt of it fell on Marie again. They began to dislike her more than ever. I even heard that they wanted to have her punished by the authorities. But thank goodness that didn't come off. But the children gave her no peace. They teased her more than ever and flung dirt. They would chase her. She would run away from them with her weak lungs, gasping for breath, and them after her, shouting and reviling. Once I even jumped in to fight with them. Then I began talking to them. I talked to them every day as much as I could. They sometimes stopped and listened, though they still abused me. I told them how unhappy Marie was. Soon they left off abusing me and walked away in silence. Little by little, we began talking together. I concealed nothing from them. I told them everything. They listened with great interest and soon began to pity Marie. And it goes on. Skip to about four lines later. One day, 2 little girls got something to eat and brought them to her. They came and told me of it. They told me that Marie started crying, and that now they loved her very much. Soon all of them began to love her, and at the same time they suddenly began to love me too. They took to coming to see me often, and always asked me to tell them stories. I think I must have told them well, for they were very fond of listening to me. And subsequently I studied and read solely so I could tell them of it afterward. And for the remaining 3 years I used to tell them stories. Later on, when everybody blamed me, including Schneider, for talking to them like grown-ups and concealing nothing from them, I would answer that it is shameful to lie to them, that they know everything anyway, however much you try to conceal things from them, and so forth. Last 3 lines on that page. I had kissed Marie a fortnight before her mother died. By the time the pastor delivered his sermon, all the children were already on my side. I at once related and explained the pastor's act to them. They were all angry with him, and some of them to such an extent that they broke the glass in his windows with stones. I stopped them, for that was wrong. But everyone in the village heard of it at once, and that was when they began to accuse me of corrupting the children. Then they all found out that the children loved Marie and were terribly alarmed. But Marie was already happy. The children were even forbidden to meet her, but they would run out on the sly to where she kept the herds. Pretty far away, sorry. Nearly half a verst from the village. They brought her dainties, and some simply ran out to hug and kiss her, say, "Je vous aime, Marie," and then run back as fast as their legs would carry them. Marie was almost beside herself at such unlooked-for happiness. She had never even dreamt of such a thing. She was chagrined and delighted. And the main thing was that the children, especially the girls, liked to run to her to tell her that I loved her and had talked to them a great deal about her. Now, I skip down eight lines or so. I think they got immense enjoyment out of my love for Marie. And on this one point, in my entire stay there, I did deceive them. I did not assure them that I did not love Marie at all. That is to say, was not in love with her, that I was simply very sorry for her. Okay. And then, as we see the decline of Marie, starting at the bottom line of this page, she was becoming very ill already. She could scarcely walk. In the end, she gave up working for the herdsman entirely, but still went out every morning with the cattle. She used to sit a little apart. There's a nearly vertical overhanging cliff there with a ledge jutting out. She used to sit in the very corner on the rock, out of sight of everyone. And she sat there almost without moving all day, from early morning till the cattle went home. She was by then so weak from consumption that she sat most of the time with her eyes shut and her head leaning against the rock and dozed, breathing heavily, and so forth. As soon as I appeared, Marie would start, open her eyes, and fall to kissing my hands. I no longer tried to take them away, for it was a joy to her. All the while that I sat with her, she trembled and wept. She did, it's true, try to speak a few times, but it was difficult to understand her. She seemed like a crazy creature in a state of terrible excitement and ecstasy. And then go down about six lines more. One morning she could no longer go out with the cows and remained at home in her empty house. The children heard of it at once, and almost all of them went to visit her that day. She lay in bed, all by, this is a bad translation, all by her lonesome. The translator, incidentally, has revised the Constance Garnett edition, so you go on with a nice, smooth, Victorian style, and then occasionally comes a clunker like all by her lonesome. For 2 days, she was tended only by the children, who ran in to see her by turns. But later, when they had heard in the village that Marie was really dying, the old women from the village started going to her to sit and keep watch. I think they had begun to pity Marie in the village. At least they did not prevent the children from seeing her and did not scold them as they had done before. Marie was drowsy all the time. Her sleep was fitful. She coughed terribly. The old women drove the children away, but they ran under the window sometimes, only for a moment, just to say, "Bonjour, notre bonne Marie." And look at the bottom line of the page. They continued to bring her dainties, but she scarcely ate anything. I assure you that thanks to them, she died almost happy. Thanks to them, she forgot her bitter trouble as if she received forgiveness from them. For up to the very end, she looked upon herself as a great sinner. They were like little birds beating their wings against her window and calling to her every morning, "Nous t'aimons, Marie." She died very soon. I had expected her to last much longer. Okay. I'm sorry to take your time up with this long passage, but I think this plunges us into the midst of the difficulty and the great contention that is Mishkan. So what do you all think? What do we notice in this passage that's important?
Mm-hmm. Well, he admits that he doesn't see anything great in Marie, really. I mean, that's his first admission, is, no, I didn't really love her.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of had sort of pity for her.
Okay.
So he's not equivocating. He's not saying, oh, the plastic bag blowing in the wind is so beautiful, or whatever, you know. No,
okay.
All right. He's not seeing beauty where there isn't any. He has an objective standard.
So are you saying he's honest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He makes the distinction between being in love and his pity for Marie. I think throughout the novel, there's a lot of times where there's love and then there's being in love, and he makes kind of subtle distinction when he's explaining it.
And both are different from pity, are they not? Because he's not going to say he's loved her or was in love with her. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Reminds me in the Gospel of Jesus saying, unless you become like a child, you can't enter the kingdom. And it seems like only the children really know how to love Marie at the beginning, and they lead the older adults to do that. You know, so this childlike quality of Michigan, you know, is really a wisdom. It's mm-hmm. a maturity that the other adults don't have, you know, being so caustic towards her.
Okay. All right. Yes.
You see him also as a storyteller. He talks about the influence he has on the children because of the stories. And you see that that's the same thing he's doing with the three ladies, is that he's telling them his stories.
Mm-hmm.
They want to keep hearing more and more. That seems to be how he gains their trust and their love.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Anybody want to see a difference, want to state a different side here?
I don't know if it's different, but the thing that stuck out to me was that he's accused of corrupting the children, which brings to mind the accusation of
a different part
Socrates.
Of the Bible.
it does.
Oh, well, no, you're quite right. It brings to mind the accusation of Socrates.
What were you thinking?
No, better to tie a millstone around your neck. Was
yeah.
No, that was
And earlier, I think, I'm not sure which of the girls, I called him a philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
So then when that accusation came up, it just made me think of the first boss.
Okay.
Pied Piper.
I'm sorry?
Pied Piper.
Pied Piper, yes. Good, good. Uh-huh. There's something of that in there. Because what does he lead them to do? Well, to throw stones at the at the preacher, right? Anything else? Mm-hmm.
Just, I was a little confused when he was saying hide nothing from them. And I wasn't, first of all, I wasn't sure how old these kids were. And I was thinking, was he just saying, you know, be perfectly frank with, you know, 12-year-olds and say, yeah, she did something she shouldn't have, but everybody's being really mean to her.
Does he ever say she's done something she shouldn't
have? He doesn't. But on the one hand, when he keeps saying, hide nothing from children, tell them everything, I'm wondering, does he mean he wants to, like, go tell 3-year-olds about the birds and the bees? Because I didn't think that was what he meant, but I was like, just what do you mean by tell kids everything?
Okay. So we've got a range of issues here.
Like, do you know what he meant? Because I'm really, like, asking.
Well, he didn't hide anything from them.
He was what?
He wasn't hiding anything from them.
Yeah. That's... could do that. All right, so do you think Marie is happy?
What do you mean by happy?
He says I'm convinced she died almost happy. Why does he say almost? Why does she become frantic every time he comes around? And let me ask you this to the women in the class, if a man kissed you and then afterwards said, I did that not because I loved you, but because I was sorry for you, how would you feel?
Horrible.
I'm sorry, what?
Horrible.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what's up with this, you see? We need to think about that. Yes, huh?
I was just going to say that, to me, like, to take pity on someone, like, it doesn't seem very loving. It seems almost like a little arrogant. Like, when you take pity on someone, you're saying, like, I'm so much better than this person. I'll kind of stoop to their level to show care and concern for them, but there's a big gap between us. You know what I mean?
You're carefully preserving your own apartness.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Pity is a judgment, right? But it's not an interaction. It's an emotion, right? But it's not an organized action that comes out. That action that comes out of that is of a different nature. Yes?
Well, he kind of opens the floodgates of kindness for her, doesn't he? If this passage is, I mean, you know, if you take his word for it, that she's, she literally has, like, no one, nothing before. She's just sort of an outcast, but he's at least if he's not, you know, like pursuing her, he's kind to her, and he's the cause of people being kind to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that that would itself would sort of transform itself to her into, you know, gratitude, even for a judgment like pity, which he didn't have before.
We're running out of time. Darn it. Okay, one more comment, yeah.
Well, it just seems to me that there's some inconsistency in his character.
Yeah.
Especially, like, he says, tell the children everything, but then he says, oh, but I lied on this one
yeah.
point. And then they go and they feed that information to Marie, and that's false. And so it just, like, escalates into this grander lie for Marie.
What is Dostoevsky doing with his character? I'm just going to have to go be blunt on this because I know the time, clock is ticking. To me, this is a presentation of our modern world. It's what we have done with the idea of the beautiful and the idea of the good. Pity is a miserable substitute for love, and yet we've convinced ourselves that this is the equivalent of love in our world, right? Pity, Rousseau said, and remember this takes place in Switzerland, another little schematic reference here, pity is the chief of virtues, according to Rousseau, who said, let's throw out all of tradition. Right? And the modern world is built on that, and Nietzsche commented on that and despised it. Right? He found that, as the Greeks, Nietzsche, found it a weak virtue. It's not a virtue, it's a vice, and so forth. Well, you know, you don't have to get on board with Nietzsche, but you see the point here. What's the chief of virtues? Is it pity? According to St. Paul? Okay, so I think we have a clear contrast here. Although it's submerged, it's not out in the open here. But there's a real difference between pity and love. Pity keeps its hands clean, you know, and keeps its dignity. Love is able, to, is willing, is finds it necessary to get its hands dirty and to not, you know, remain with being good and proper and a teacher, and so forth. This is such a tempting passage because we have the teacher figure, we have the community that's formed, we have a revolt against authority, which we all love. We have, you know, so many aspects here that appeal to us. Why? Not because Dostoevsky, I think, is trying to trick us, not because he's doing some form of secret writing or something, but because I think he's trying to present to us our world and the self-deceptions that we have fallen into. Mishkin is not to blame for this. Mishkin is an innocent who is well-intentioned, but he is also, his presence and his well-intentions, good intentions in the world are inefficacious. And we must think about Marie as a parallel to Nastasya Philipovna, who, as you know, has been molested, really, basically, in her life by Totsky. Who has grown out of that, has become a self-ruling, wonderfully impressive, beautiful, powerful woman, but with a great deal of bitterness, and to whom Mishkin offers the same message. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. And after the proposals of marriage, she is tempted so very much to go with Mishkin, but until she realizes at the last minute, what an absurd idea. Ruin a child like that, she says, and she dashes off with Rogozhin, or Rogozhin, I don't know really how you pronounce his name.
Yeah, I think
really, because to debase herself with Rogozhin would be better than to enter the unreal world that Mishkin supposes to offer. So think about that, and think what would Christ do? Yeah, WJD on this, because Jesus doesn't say, it's not your fault, does he? To the woman taken in adultery, he says, your sins are forgiven, go and sin no more. Neither do I condemn you, but go and sin no more. There ain't nothing about sin in here. There is something in the person that wants to confront that wickedness that one has done, even if one was a victim in doing it. And that's the same thing that that dogs, Marie as dogs, Nastasia, Philip Ovna. So think about that. That's all. We'll look more carefully at parts 1 and 2 next time, and there will be that quiz.
And the Pushkin speech is on Blackboard.
Yay. That's a great speech.
Yeah, you really do understand a lot about Russian literature in this period just from reading that speech.
Oh, yes. Okay, graduate students, I didn't forget. Okay, guys. Oh, yeah. Adam. I'll let you know.